As head of the Australian Law Reform Commission for 10 years, David Weisbrot has worked on many highly regarded reports. Reports that have tackled big, complex topics like genetics, access to the civil court system, privacy and sedition. David Weisbrot has spent the bulk of his career pondering how the law and indeed all our institutions can be organised in a way that produces the best results across society. And these sorts of questions have preoccupied him from a very young age.
I grew up in New York for the first 11 years of my life in Brooklyn, and then a little bit later in Queens. In fact, I went from polar opposite neighborhoods. I went from a very poor and almost entirely black and Hispanic primary school. And then when I was in junior high, or sixth grade, my family moved to the Forest Hills area, which was very affluent, upper middle class. And I think there were three black kids in my high school. It was almost the polar opposite of my primary school experience.
You've described it as the photographic negative.
That's right, yeah.
For a long time, you returned almost every week to play sport with your old friends, but inevitably, over time, those trips became less and less frequent. And when you did return after a long absence, you were pretty shocked by what you found.
That's right. I found a few of my old friends where we used to play basketball, and I asked them about, I asked after a whole range of other people, and it was... I still remember to this day, it was a long time ago now, way more than 40 years ago, but I remember just hearing one after another, so-and-so is dead, dead, in jail, dead, in jail, dead, and so on. And almost all of it related to drugs. Either they had died of overdoses or they were in jail for selling drugs or engaging in a fight over drugs or they died in a fight over drugs. So it was something that really just savaged that entire neighborhood, you know, from a period when I was there with, blissful ignorance as a primary school student, and all you did was, you know, run around and play sport with your friends, and then coming back some years later and finding out that the whole neighborhood had been devastated.
So that experience and that recognition was quite important for you because you, from quite an early age, were thinking about how lives are shaped by a complex mix of factors, including race, culture, dispossession, social disadvantage, and education and access to education. And I guess big questions about how society organises itself and the results that these choices can produce.
That's right. And one factor you have to throw in, I guess, is luck, apart from anything else, sheer luck. But from an early age, I was thinking about, you know, why not me? I mean, how is it that I got lucky and got out and went to good schools and had supportive parents and all of that sort of thing and was able to make a career, a professional career? And other friends of mine who are equally smart and diligent and nice and kind never made it out of primary school and never made it out of high school anyway. So I get, yeah, all of those issues about how society was organized and fairness and justice and access to education, access to services, the way we label some activities as criminal when they're probably more about health or rebellion.
Now, just a few days ago, former High Court Justice Michael Kirby, who's also, incidentally, a former head of the Australian Law Reform Commission, he spoke out about the importance of public education and the need to fund it properly. And it sounds like you share that passion because you were just saying a moment ago that education and access to it are important determinants about where somebody might end up.
Michael's not only a former president, but a very dear friend of mine, and I guess a mentor throughout my professional career. It's a passion we both share. I always saw it as the way out of a desperate situation of disadvantage. And it's the great leveler, or it should be, setting kids along a level playing field on their way through life, giving people opportunity, giving them access to opportunity to learning and ultimately to careers and a more satisfying and safe life. And I've been true to my word. Both my kids went through the public school system. My wife and I are products of the public school system, and I feel very strongly about the fact that we have to, not that I'm opposed to private education for some, but I think we have to maintain the highest possible standards and resourcing of our public schools because they service the broader population and especially people who come from disadvantaged backgrounds.
And do you reckon we're doing enough right now?
No, I don't think we have the balance right at the moment, and it saddens me when I see enormous resources pumped into some of the private schools so they can have the third footy field or the second swimming pool, when at my daughter's school, for example, which is an excellent one in Sydney, but they didn't have air conditioning and had to decide which was worse, to swelter in the classroom and to open the windows and hear all the traffic noise.
Now, after a 10-year term, you've just stepped down as president of the Australian Law Reform Commission. In a nutshell, very briefly, what is the role of a Law Reform Commission?
There are about 60 or so of them around the world. I probably will also step down as the president of the International Association of Law Reform Agencies now. And their charters are similar, but their work is a little bit different from country to country, depending on the circumstances. And by and large, they're charged with keeping the law in step with society, in step with technological and scientific and other kind of developments. So sometimes laws need modernizing because the technology has changed very dramatically. Privacy would be a very good example of that, or the protection of human genetic information. Sometimes laws need modernization because we've changed our social attitudes. So the consenting homosexual behavior would be one example of that, or de facto marriage, or other areas in which we take a different approach socially to previous generations.
And in the 1990s, you worked with the New South Wales Law Reform Commission, and you recommended or involved in inquiries which recommended the reform of laws in a range of areas, including blasphemy, police powers of arrest and detention, and defences to murder. But I believe that the inquiry that really captured the public imagination was a more perhaps prosaic one. It was an inquiry looking at neighbours and neighbour relations.
That's right. This came out of the New South Wales Law Reform Commission's community law reform program, in which anybody in the community can write in and say, here's a problem we reckon you should be working on. And quite a few people had written in on a grab bag of topics on neighbor-neighbor relations and neighborhood disputes. And really what they boiled down to, we had a hotline that was well publicized by the newspapers and radio and even TV. And we allowed a few days for people to phone in. And the response was so overwhelming, in fact, that we had to add 6 extra phone lines to the commission because the switchboard was jammed from morning to night. And the disputes really resolved down to 3 major areas. It was trees, noise, and dogs. And occasionally those intersected, of course, because you have noisy trees and noisy dogs. But, it was amazing.
You have noisy trees?
You can. We had complaints about people whose neighbors' trees were creaking in the wind and keeping them up. So it was that wasn't the predominant noise problem, but it was certainly one that cut across. But people very passionate and very upset. And of course, it's an area where you can't just walk away. You're talking about your neighborhood, so you can have a dispute with somebody, you know, in a car, road rage, and you drive away. But at home, you've got your neighbors and you see them every day. And people also felt that there wasn't an easy way of resolving those disputes. So they'd ring the council and the council would tell them to ring the police. The police would refer them to the council and so on and so on.
Did that surprise you, that the inquiry that generated the most heat and captured the public imagination perhaps more than the others, what was this quite day-to-day prosaic kind of area?
Well, it did surprise me at the time, although in retrospect, maybe I shouldn't have been so surprised about it, because it's the pointy end at which most people experience law disputes. And so, fortunately, very few people have the experience of either being a victim or a defendant in a homicide. And so, although those are notorious and get the newspaper coverage, we're talking about relatively few cases affecting relatively few people in the community. Whereas these issues about noise and trees and getting on together and parking and all that kind of thing are the things that irritate us all. So I guess in retrospect, I'm not so surprised about that.
I'm Damien Carrick. You're listening to The Law Report on ABC Radio National. And today, a conversation with David Weisbrot, who's stepping down from the head of the Australian Law Reform Commission after 10 years at the helm. In 1999, you were appointed as president of the Australian Law Reform Commission. And in the subsequent 10 years, you worked on many reports, including one on genetics, which is titled essentially yours, one on sedition, which was titled Fighting Words, one on privacy, which was titled For Your Information, and one on classified information, which was titled Keeping Secrets. Now, some of these areas, and in particular areas like genetics and privacy, the technologies and the practices at play here are evolving monthly. I mean, you weren't being asked to examine a static framework. I mean, it was about getting wider principles in place that would govern how we deal with these constantly unfolding landscapes. It's not a question of etching out a detailed black letter piece of legislation. It's about something else.
That's right. And yeah, I think in both of those reports, we concluded by saying we really don't want to do this inquiry every 2 or 3 years. So what we've tried to do is to not only get on top of the existing and emerging technology, but do a bit of horizon scanning and saying, where is it all going and how can we regulate this field in a way that's technology aware but technology neutral, so we don't need to dramatically change the legislation every time we move slightly from one platform to another. So I think we were able to do a pretty good job of predicting that. And so far, essentially yours was released 6 years ago, and I think we've been pretty spot on the developments over this period. And I think it's a robust enough report that it will last at least another decade or two. And that's probably all you can expect in a rapidly advancing area of science and technology. Similarly, in privacy, we talked to all the leading technical people at Microsoft and Google and many of the other major IT firms to give us a good idea of where the technology was going and the social applications of that technology, so that we weren't writing a report for today. We were really writing one that would last at least 10 or 20 years.
You've worked with some extraordinary people, some of them very, very well known, but you've also spoken to people who have no names. I believe that was especially the case when you did the report on classified information, which was titled Keeping Secrets, and that was back in 2004.
Yeah, that's right. We met a whole lot of people who were straight out of central casting there. So we had people who came to the ALRC offices and, you know, with lots of interesting ideas, and they presented us with their business cards, and then they pause for effect and say, well, that's not actually my name. That's not actually my job. That's not actually my telephone number. That's not actually my email address. So you wondered why they bothered with the business card, but they obviously had a lot of other insights.
So the spooks didn't give much away, but I mean, did you find that they provided useful information?
They were quite good and forthright in discussing how their systems worked, and I think they were quite good and forthright in discussing what didn't work very well. And of course, for a law reformer, that's actually what you're after.
Mm. Of course, you don't only talk to spooks and world-famous scientists and experts of all stripes. The work of the Law Reform Commission is also to consult with ordinary people. I remember, a few years ago now, when the ALRC was conducting an inquiry into genetics, the Essentially Yours inquiry, I attended one of the public meetings, and the people who turned up were an extraordinary cross-section. I remember there were lawyers, there were doctors, and there were lots of ordinary people living with genetic conditions. How important were these meetings for you?
Absolutely essential. Yeah, that meeting, in fact, that you attended was the first of 17 major public consultations we had, or big public forums that we had around the country on genetic information. And I have to say, we get very helpful, big written submissions from the usual players, government departments, the Law Council of Australia, the Australian Medical Association, and so on. But I think the most valuable in shaping the pragmatic and practical recommendations that we like to make come from ordinary people who are in the system and who actually have to experience it day to day, don't have much of a hidden agenda at all, other than they often don't want other people to have to go through some of the same nonsense that they went through. And in genetics, it was particularly the case, I think, to have it from the patient point of view, or from the family point of view, or the genetic support group point of view, even more so than from the hospital administrators or the very top officials.
Can you tell me about some of what people said in these meetings and whether it made you, maybe knocked you off balance, made you think about the world in a completely new or different way.
Yeah, I remember a few of those. In genetics, for example, in the Melbourne meeting, at the end of the meeting, a woman came up to me at the end, the formal session had finished, and she said, I found that very interesting and I came along as a member of the community. I have two granddaughters who are in the Jewish school system in Melbourne, and they are part of a routine TASAC screening program that's conducted through the school.
And what's TASAC?
Tay-Sachs is quite a nasty genetic disorder where if you're a carrier, it's not a problem. But if two Tay-Sachs carriers produce a child, then that child will probably live a very short and painful life. It's really a terrible disease. So, of course, what you're trying to do is identify carriers and not have them reproduce, or at least not in a normal way, without some sort of medical intervention to make sure the disease isn't passed on. And they do it through the school system there because it's a good way of catching a large portion of the community. But she said, I understand why it's done and I basically support it, but I also have some serious misgivings. And I said, oh, what are those? And she didn't say another word, but she just rolled up her sleeve and showed me her Nazi concentration camp tattoo. And immediately that spoke volumes, of course, about eugenics, about record keeping, about what happens if this sort of information falls into the wrong hands. And so I think it made me think much more about the privacy aspects. There's been a tendency in the Australian media in recent times to poo-poo privacy as something that only celebrities and wealthy people care about, and it's an upper middle class obsession. But when you meet somebody for whom privacy was a life and death matter, then I think you take it a lot more seriously and you give a lot more thought to how you can protect that.
The task of a law reform body is often to deal with difficult issues. I'm thinking of Victoria, where some years ago the Victorian Law Reform Commission was told to look at abortion, which is, of course, a huge political hot potato. And this decision to handball over to the Victorian Law Reform Commission, that allowed the government to say, we're going to have some serious minds at arm's length from the government, look at this and see what they come up with. And I think many people would say the process gave the Victorian government the political space to implement politically difficult reforms. I mean, is that the task of a law reform commission?
Yeah, in a way. I mean, not in a cynical way. But I think my mantra in this area has always been, if the government knows what it wants to do, then it should do it. It has a whole big Attorney General's department to draft legislation and discussion papers and so on. That it's really where the government doesn't know what it wants to do, that it should refer the matter to a law reform body, which then has the time and the ability to kind of really explore different options and provide the government with the best possible advice.
Cynics or critics would say that when a government gives a reference to a law reform commission, it's basically allowing a government to push a reform agenda, but it's done by sleight of hand, with the pretense that government is being objective or truly open to new ideas, when in fact it knows what it wants to hear and it pretty much knows what the law reform commission will recommend.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I've never been the recipient of the hospital pass, I guess, or the cynical reference. And again, law reform commissions are independent. So as long as the terms of reference are sufficiently open, and that's, I guess, where I've been a stickler. I've always been able to negotiate, both at New South Wales and the ALRC, I've been able to negotiate with the attorneys about the exact nature of the terms of reference, and I've made sure they were wide open. And I know that sometimes the government would have liked slightly different recommendations. It would have made their life easier or more convenient. We've always felt it was our duty to present them with the best advice rather than the advice that they wanted to hear.
Jan Wade, the Attorney General in the 1990s Kennett government in Victoria, she disbanded the Victorian Law Reform Commission back then. And at the time, she accused it essentially of being a branch of the ALP. The accusation was that it wasn't independent. And she said something along the lines of, governments are perfectly capable of thinking up changes to the law without a law reform commission. What makes such a body potentially valuable is its theoretical capacity to introduce a separate and critical note in debates over legislative reform. Regrettably, the Victorian Law Reform Commission has too often operated less as an independent statutory authority and more as a loyal branch of the Attorney General's department. I mean, that criticism has been levelled by Conservative political parties in Victoria back in the 1990s, I think in Canada in more recent times. It's a pretty common criticism, isn't it?
It can be, certainly, and it's the most dangerous thing for a Law Reform Commission to be seen to be too closely aligned to one side of politics or the other, or just to government generally, I guess, rather than being an independent body. Let's take one step away from that criticism. I think the ALRC and other good law reform bodies work best when they're treated as an honest broker and treated as being fiercely and rigorously independent. And I know that at the ALRC, we received throughout the 10 years so many very sensitive personal stories from individuals, which they would never have told to government, in inverted commas. And similarly, we had many businesses or peak associations give us commercial and confidence information that, again, they never would have given to something that they saw as government. So I think having that arm's length is very critical, being seen as that independent, honest broker. And of course, it's an intellectual independence. Most law reform commissions are funded almost entirely by government, but I guess in the same way the courts are as well. You have to maintain a very vigorous independence that way. So we've been pretty lucky here in Canada, in Victoria, and some other areas. I'm not testifying to the accuracy or otherwise of the criticisms, but that is what gets a law reform commission into trouble, is where it's seen as being part and parcel of one party.
We've been talking about law reform commissions being perceived as tools or instruments of government. But turning the Rubik's Cube around, did a government ever appear appalled, or did their jaws drop when the Australian Law Reform Commission made some of its recommendations? Did you ever have the opposite response, that you're not a tool, but rather you're somehow quite subversive?
Probably the closest we got to that was with the Sedition Laws inquiry. You might remember that the government had pushed through changes to the federal criminal code in the area of sedition laws, despite some considerable concern expressed in the community among writers and artists and civil libertarians. There was even concern among some members of the Liberal Party that the laws were too intrusive. And so the government passed the legislation anyway, but the then Attorney General, Philip Ruddock, agreed to send the laws to an independent review. And he chose to send them. I think there were other members of the party that also agreed that it should go to the ALRC, again, because of our perceived and real independence. And basically, our recommendations were entirely for repeal. So I think we debunked a few notions that the laws were really evil. I mean, they weren't that, but they were a bit overly broad, and they could be used in ways that would, if not directly stifle freedom of speech, then at least cause a bit of fear and self-censorship. And so we recommended pretty firmly that the laws be changed. And I don't think that was what the attorney wanted us to say, or hoped we were going to say. But to give him his due, not long after I handed in the report, I sat next to Philip Ruddock at a dinner that was farewelling somebody, I can't remember whom, from government. And he just looked at me and said, well, it was not exactly what I was hoping for. But I have to hand it to you, it was a very professional report, very well written, and we'll take it very seriously.
Did Philip Ruddock change the law?
He didn't at that time. That was pretty close to the election in 2007. And Labor went into that election with part of its party platform being expressly to implement the ALRC's report on sedition laws called Fighting Words. And it is in the process of doing that now.
And what's been the track record of the Australian Law Reform Commission in terms of the implementation of its recommendations?
Over the whole 35 years or so of existence, it's about 90% of reports have been recommended either partly or substantially. I forget the breakup. It's about equal in those two categories. But it's a pretty proud one. I think there are very few law reform bodies in the world that would have an equally high implementation rate.
David Weisbrot, what areas of law have not been scrutinised by an Australian law reform inquiry that you think maybe should be scrutinised?
Well, there's still whole big areas. One of them is in relation to the law of territories. Australia has a lot of offshore territories like Cocos and Keeling Islands and Christmas Island and Norfolk and so on. All of them are enacted under their own legislation at different times, at different historical periods. So in some cases, Australian law automatically applies in that territory. In some places, it automatically doesn't apply unless there's a special act or a special gazette.
And real issues around, say, asylum seekers.
Yeah, that came to the fore, I think, when the Australian government was excising parts of our territory in order to fit in with migration laws. I mean, we didn't anticipate that issue precisely, but it was certainly among the cluster of things we were thinking about. More in the area, I guess, of matching up law and medicine. So the Human Tissue Acts in Australia that came in the middle 70s, again a product of the early days of the Australian Law Reform Commission, are now about 30 years old, and they were enacted for the brave new world of organ transplantation. But I think they need renewal and uniformity, a national approach to things like fetal cord blood and stem cells and all the more modern medical technology that we have to deal with these days. And so there are a range of other things. I think federalism itself probably needs a bit of looking at. One issue that we were trying to get successive governments interested in was just federal arrangements. So we have different sort of the Murray River Authority, for example, is constructed of various types of state and local and federal involvement. And that's an increasing part of Australian governance, is trying to find ways to manage big issues in a way that the Constitution probably didn't anticipate. And so looking at how we organise, what's the best blueprint, the options, what are the factors that you take into account when you're dealing with big issues in federalism in practice?
Coming full circle, at the beginning of this conversation we spoke about your childhood friends, many of whom ended up in prison or dead, and that was largely as a result of the use of drugs or involvement in the drugs trade. Putting on your LRC hat, your Law Reform Commission hat, do you have a view about the best way for society to treat drugs and the damage that they can cause?
Well, I have a strong view that the way we've tried has failed demonstrably. I think by and large what we needed to do is to take a much more of a public health approach to it, and maybe even I have friends who are much more into market economics than I am, who think that there would have been benefits going that way to legalize and tax. But certainly I think the public health aspect of it, I think the war on drugs using that kind of military approach and policing approach has really failed communities all around the world, and you can see the fallout from it, not only in the statistics of people who have died or had serious health ailments from their drug use, but also the way it's distorted the criminal justice system and ravaged many of our communities.
David Weisbrot, it's been a great pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much for speaking to the Law Report.
My pleasure, Damien.
David Weisbrot, who is stepping down after a decade as president of the Australian Law Reform Commission. And before that, for 10 years, he was a commissioner with the New South Wales Law Reform Commission.